Die Presse.
Dieser Podcast wird unterstützt von Erste Group und Vienna Insurance Group.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu uns. Jetzt lache ich erst, das geht
nicht. Ja gut, das lassen wir aufs Handy, damit das Publikum mitkriegt, wie es bei uns lustig ist. Komm.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu unserem Podcast East Side Stories. Wir sind Martina Czarnowska
und Thomas Seifert.
Jetzt sitzen wir wieder im Studio in Wien. Aber du warst eben in Prag, oder?
In Prag, genau. Und zwar war ich auf der Sicherheitskonferenz Globsec in der schönen Hauptstadt Tschechiens. Und von dieser Sicherheitskonferenz ist übrigens die European Voices, unser Magazin, Medienpartner. Und auch ganz interessant, die Globsec musste 2024 von Bratislava nach Prag übersiedeln. Jetzt fragst du dich sicher, was war der Grund?
Ja. Na gut, das tue ich.
Das kann ich dir schon erzählen. Der Grund war, der ist leider sehr ernst, und zwar waren die Organisatorinnen und Organisatoren, die haben sich in der Slowakei unter Ministerpräsident Robert Fico nicht mehr sehr willkommen gefühlt. Auf einem der Podien ging es übrigens auch um Populismus in Mittelosteuropa. Da hat zum Beispiel der Carsten Mudde von der University of Georgia, ein renommierter Politikwissenschaftler, der sich seit vielen Jahren mit Populismus beschäftigt, uns erklärt, warum extreme Rhetorik heute zum Repertoire von Populisten gehört. Seine Analyse, ich zitiere ihn jetzt: Um heute im Diskurs etwas zu bewegen, musst du extreme Aussagen machen. Es ist wie bei Süchtigen. Die ersten paar Schüsse wirken, aber dann musst du die Dosis erhöhen. Und was war der Konsens auf diesem Podium? Den kann man ungefähr so wiedergeben, dass das Ringen der Kräfte der demokratischen Mitte mit den Populisten derzeit der entscheidende politische Konflikt in Europa ist.
Und besonders gut ist das ja in Wahlzeiten zu sehen. Ich denke da an zwei Beispiele. Ende Mai hat es in zwei EU-Ländern Wahlen gegeben. Ein neuer Staatspräsident wurde bestimmt. Es waren demokratische Wahlen, also formell gibt es keinen Grund zur Klage. Doch aus einer EU-Perspektive ist es in einem Land nochmal gut gegangen und im anderen nicht so ganz. Es hat sich in Rumänien Nico Jordan gegen seinen rechtsradikalen Rivalen durchgesetzt. Sehr zur Freude des Pro-EU-Lagers, wie du weißt. In Polen aber gewann der nationalkonservative Kandidat Karol Nawrocki, der das Nationale eben sehr betont. Und Rafał Trzaskowski, der Warschauer Bürgermeister, hat knapp verloren. Aus diesem Anlass habe ich Ludwika Wordek um eine kurze Nachwahlanalyse gebeten. Sie ist Soziologin und Publizistin und lehrt an der Universität Warschau. Und sie hat uns folgende Sprachnachricht geschickt.
Voice Message. What's up, Warschau?
Dzień dobry. Tu Ludwika Włodek z Warszawy. Why did Karol Nawrocki win the presidential elections? Because he was very convincing to all the voters of supporting him, a Law and Justice Party, the party which ruled Poland till the parliamentary elections 2 years ago. And he was also convincing to the far-right voters who hate the elites. He was playing with his image of a self-made man, which is, by the way, not at all true, because he was entirely made by Law and Justice Party. In the same time, Rafał Trzaskowski didn't know how to convince those who voted for the ruling coalition, but do not necessarily support Civic Platform, his party. He was flirting with right-wing supporters, which is not necessarily the best idea, because he was neglecting the left voters. And actually, he should have done it, because the potential was on the left side for him to win.
Das war die Soziologin und Publizistin Ludwika Wordek. Das von ihr angesprochene Flirten mit den Rechten oder Radikalen aus Sorge, dass linke Stimmen nicht ausreichen könnten, ist ja generell ein polnisches Phänomen. Es fügt sich ein in diesen weltweiten Trend, mit Populismus und Polarisierung Politik zu machen, von dem wir ja vorher auch gesprochen haben. Machen wir jetzt aber einen Sprung von einem großen EU-Land zu einem Votum in zwei kleinen Gemeinden in Serbien. Was hältst du davon?
Gut, ja, ein guter Sprung, und zwar von Polen nach Kosaric und Zadica. Das sind zwei Gemeinden in Serbien. Und die Lokalwahlen dort haben gezeigt, dass die Macht von Präsident Vucic bröckelt. Und zwar, warum? Die Opposition hat dort der regierenden SNS deutlich Stimmen abgejagt. Und die Opposition wurde von den Studenten und von dieser Studentenbewegung unterstützt. Und die fühlt sich nun bestärkt. Und die sieht in diesen Wahlen ein Zeichen dafür, dass die monatelangen Proteste offenbar Wirkung zeigen.
Interessanterweise hast du mit unserem Gesprächspartner für diese Podcast-Folge ja auch über Serbien gesprochen. Der renommierte serbischstämmige Ökonom Branko Milanović analysiert die Lage in Serbien im Gespräch ziemlich nüchtern. Auf Englisch klingt das extra dry.
Ja, absolut. Extra dry. In den Studentenprotesten sieht Milanović, ich zitiere ihn jetzt wieder, einen totalen Kollaps des repräsentativen Systems, also einen Zusammenbruch der repräsentativen Demokratie in Serbien. Und er sagt, das Problem sei wie folgt. Du hast drei Seiten, sagt er, das Regime, die Oppositionsparteien und die Studenten- und Bürgerbewegung. Die Studenten mögen sowohl die Opposition als auch das Vucic-Regime nicht.
Das klingt ziemlich verzwickt, aber ist Milanovics wichtigstes Forschungsthema nicht eigentlich ein anderes, nämlich die Ungleichheit?
Genau, die Ungleichheit, soziale Ungleichheit. Und mich würde es übrigens auch nicht wundern, wenn er eines Tages den Wirtschaftsnobelpreis für seine Forschungen zu diesem Thema bekommt. Milanovics zentrale These ist, dass die Eliten das Problem erst jetzt ernst nehmen, wo sie die politischen Konsequenzen sehen. Von Donald Trump eben bis hin zum Erstarken der Populisten in Osteuropa. Milanović sagt, dass es zwei Lösungsansätze für dieses Problem der sozialen Ungleichheit gibt, nämlich einerseits höhere Steuern für Reiche und andererseits besseren Zugang zu Bildung und Kapital für Ärmere.
So, aber jetzt lassen wir Branko Milanović bitte selbst zu Wort kommen.
Today in the studio we have Branko Milanović, who is a preeminent economist, and he is especially known for his work on inequality, on social inequality and economic inequality. He has been working on this topic for, I think, decades, one can say. Just a new book came out recently, now also the German version has just hit the bookshelves. So let's start with the question that I always ask the guests is, where did you just come from?
Well, first, thank you very much for actually having me. Of course, it's always a pleasure to be in Vienna. I did come from not very far because I came from Budapest. And I came from a conference which took place about political capitalism. You can actually argue that to some extent Hungary is in a political capitalism mode. But what I found most interesting is the number of papers on different countries that are either close to that model, and how, in some sense, you can actually even consider capitalism to be in a different types of political capitalism, including, for example, Trump in the United States. Is it some form of oligarchic or political capitalism?
Yeah, that's very interesting, especially when the political scientists, when they hear, you know, talk about Hungary, they use a term of competitive authoritarianism, which means it's not an authoritarian regime, but there is elements to it. And of course, it's still competitive. There are still elections. There are still kind of, let's say, elements of democracy left. And where do these two things come together, especially when we talk about these countries that you just mentioned, Hungary especially? Do people there in Budapest think that this is actually beneficial for their economies, that they have this political system?
You know, I think we deal, at least I deal, with a biased sample, because people that I... This is not my first time to be in Budapest. People whom I tend to meet are academics, and I would say they're 90% of whom I meet are people who are opposed to Orban. The Erdogan is not the same as Orban, you know. Orban is not the same as Trump, and so forth. But there are certain similarities that, you know, political scientists are actually studying more. And I think last point, just to mention, the varieties of capitalism literature, which was big in political science, was really limited to essentially West European countries. And North America. I think when you look at the countries of Central and Eastern Europe that used to be communist over a period of 35 years, that legacy, in my opinion, is there is one, but I don't think it's very strong anymore. You know, maybe like 15 years ago, I thought it was stronger, but nowadays I see it basically that these countries have, when you look about the inequality, very Central European level of inequality. And what not too many people know, but if you take five countries, Austria, Hungary, Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Slovenia, they are the countries with the lowest level of inequality combined with Nordic countries, Finland especially, and Sweden still, although Sweden has really had an increase in inequality. And I see it really kind of a Central European model, where I don't think that it really was communism per se that it makes relatively low inequality in these countries. It is actually set up of the system. These are relatively small countries with homogeneous population. I don't mean here ethnically or religiously, but in terms of education level. And that, I think, makes the situation of these countries different from the rest of maybe Europe or, you know, certainly of the post-Soviet space. Mm.
And also, what about those countries that are not yet part of the European Union? For instance, of course, Serbia among them, Albania, right. Bosnia. What is the situation there, you think?
Well, when it comes to inequality, actually, Serbia and Macedonia have fairly high inequality. But I think in Serbia, it is driven by the urban-rural differences, because Belgrade especially and Novi Sad, which is the second largest city, are doing reasonably well. And the countryside is really doing very badly. Of course, you know, like similar to the rest of Eastern Europe, people leave the place, or what, people who remain there, there is really no employment, nothing practically to do. So there is a big urban-rural gap, which, by the way, is, of course, as you know, is between Budapest and the rest of Hungary. Nowadays, Bucharest is actually doing extremely well and much better than the rest of Romania. And it is true that actually the bi-coastal elites, meaning the East Coast and, of course, the West Coast, don't really have much contact with the rest of the United States. And likewise, I could imagine, although I don't know Romania well, but I know that it had big IT boom, and that Bucharest, according to whatever, I was not there recently, but people tell me it's actually really booming. And the social indicators in Romania are not good at all, while the GDP, actually Romania a couple of years had a really Chinese rates of growth of 7 or 8%, quite extraordinary. So yes, there is obviously this kind of a disconnect between the booming parts of the country, including, for example, London in the UK and the rest of the country. First, the reason why I think the elites are now very concerned is for political reasons, because we just talked about the US and Romania, and clearly the cleavage is social, and cleavage is driven by inequality, and it translates into the political sphere. So long as it was not translated into the political sphere, I think the elites were very happy to talk about that and do nothing. But when it comes to remedies, I would distinguish between two general propositions. One type of remedy is to increase taxation on the rich, on capital, and so on. And I'm not against it. I think it's okay. In some cases, the taxes may be increased. But it's also the case, as you know, I mean, in Europe, that the taxes are high, that people don't want to be taxed more, and they resent that. Nor do they believe that the government is using that money efficiently. So the second type of remedies is to do things on increased access to education and ability of the poorer people to actually accede to university education and beyond. And secondly, to try to spread the ownership of capital or financial assets. So you can see these are two complementary approaches, but they're a little bit different because one really aims at taxation mostly. The other aims at changing what economists call endowments, education and capital.
And also what you said before is that, of course, Central Eastern Europe, Eastern Europe, they have a special problem, which is, of course, not, I mean, you have the same problems even in Korea with, you know, demographic time bomb, basically. But of course, when we look at Europe for a moment now, then we see, of course, the problem is most pronounced in Southeastern Europe and in Eastern Europe. So what do you think that means for inequality also? Because, of course, it means, you know, that there's less young people. Those who have a chance, they leave. Yeah. Then some maybe profit from remittances, those who their kids went abroad. Others maybe have nobody. So what do you see there? Is there research on that? Do we know what happens with inequality because of the demographic challenges?
I really don't know if there is a research on that. But one thing we all talk about migration. It is, of course, a huge topic in Europe, again, because of the political implications of that. But when I studied, actually, as you mentioned before, global inequality, one thing which kind of jumps at you, obviously huge differences in mean country incomes. If you take, for example, Netherlands and Mali, we are talking about 10 to 1 or maybe 12 to 1. And then you look at Gallup poll, which does ask this question, are you planning to leave the country, to migrate? And then ask three types of questions to distinguish if you have made some actual steps to leave. So, you know, the problem of migration is not only the problem on the recipient side, it's also on the emitting side.
And one could also argue that probably if you have especially those highly qualified who leave, then also that might change the political equilibrium in the country. Sure. Because, of course, the intellectual class, if they leave, this leaves, like a stain almost on kind of, let's say, on the intellectual landscape, no?
Absolutely, because, of course, as we were saying, more educated people would leave, then for political life, it would make a difference, intellectual life as well. And let me just give, for example, an example of a friend of mine, my age, actually, he's now about to retire. He is an engineer in sanitation, sewage, and water control, water quality control. And for small countries like Serbia with 7 million people, you know, how many such engineers do you produce annually? I don't know, maybe five of them. And he was saying, actually, with the current situation and, of course, the immigration of labor, because they get paid much more in Austria and Germany, he says, no, there will be nobody to control water quality. Now, economists tell you, okay, that's, I mean, theoretically, they say, oh, it's not the problem. You would have somebody from Egypt to come. But, you know, it takes time. The Egyptian guy is not going to appear, you know, in Serbia tomorrow. If he ever comes, it would be in 5 years. So what will happen in 5 years if you don't have anybody to control the water quality?
So, Branko, at this point in our conversation, I should probably bring up that you are originally from Serbia.
Yeah.
And that brings me to the question, Serbia, question mark.
I really see it as a failure, total collapse of the representative system. It's actually, in my opinion, it's a collapse of a representative democracy in Serbia. And I'll explain that. The Student Popular Movement dislikes both the opposition and the Vučić regime. So, and they actually claim that they would like to introduce direct democracy. So you really have a collapse of the parliamentary system or the representation.
And they will look at politics in Serbia, and I think it's fair to say that what they see is a lot of dirty machinations, right, power politics. So I think for, let's say, you're young, idealistic, maybe a little bit naive person.
That actually, in the very beginning, that was a protest movement because of what happened with 15 people who died because of corruption, there is no doubt. And but then you have to actually, it is very hard, and I understand these young people that they didn't know how to do that. You have to have a political articulation of your demands in a political sense. And they have not been able to do that, and I'm afraid that actually the whole movement would fizzle out and lead to a discouragement.
So the question is, do you think that also with patience, maybe this is another step in this, let's say, the Serbian path?
Maybe, but you know, on the other hand, you can also see that Serbia maybe, like there are a couple of other countries, we can talk about them also, a country with a circular history. It's actually an interesting idea that Naples had when he talked about Argentina. He said Argentina is a country with circular history. The same story repeats itself forever. And actually, if you take Milei now, it was, with a similar story that happened before. So it's all the time, he says Argentina for the last 100 plus years, it's the same story repeating. And of course, they get, some get jobs, some get contracts, others get more privileged tax treatment, but there is something to be solved. And I think that Greece has a system which is not very different. It's essentially, there was, as you know, there was also great corruption there with and there were lots of demonstrations also when there was a train crash. And that was again seen as the corruption of public works and low quality work. And I believe that was probably true.
Mm. But again, staying with the Serbian topic, you talked about brain drain. Basically, you are one of this element of brain drain, mm-hmm, because also you left Serbia. You are a very well-known economist. What do you have there? Any idea, you know, how to go to kind of from a brain drain to a brain gain? That how could these countries lure back talent? What kind of initiatives they could take to kind of get back these? Because it would make sense.
Well, it's a little bit of a catch-22 because people, for me, it's irrelevant because I'm too old for that, but I mean, for people in the middle ages, it's kind of the catch-22 because they think actually, yes, I'm really happy to go there, you know, for cultural reasons. I have friends and so on. That's how people think. But things have to improve. But the problem, things will not improve until you come there. So it's actually catch-22. So it's actually somebody else who has to improve things for me to go back there. But that somebody else are people exactly like me who do exactly the same reasoning. You know, it's a game theory. It's essentially nothing then changes. We are in an equilibrium where nobody moves back because since nobody moves back, things do not get better.
And why do you think is now a time where we again talk about social inequality, economic inequality?
No, you were absolutely right. You know, I went through all that period, you know, the period where actually inequality was really a non-topic, you know, and for many reasons, political or because, you know, the economies were growing. You know, this is the famous, les trente glorieuses of what Jean Forestier invented the term of basically European growth. And actually, I think Austria is a phenomenal example of that. If you take Austria in like 1950 or 1948, and then if you look at the rate of growth, then over the next 30, 35 years, it's actually phenomenal. And on the other hand, of course, inequality even went down because the welfare state became stronger, there was way greater taxation, there was actually greater social transfers. So inequality to some extent was not a huge topic. You know, I'm not saying that it never was a topic, but it was not as a topic as it became later. And I think actually the turning point, in my opinion, was the financial crisis.
And do you also see when discussions are in about this topic about inequality, are they different in Central Eastern Europe, Eastern Europe than, let's say, in Western Europe or the United States? Are there differences in the debate, you think?
I think there are strong similarities among all advanced countries. But there are, of course, individual differences. In the U.S., I think the difference is that the political implications of the topic now have become very, very stark. And actually, they became stark even with the first election of Trump. But people believed, and there was just an article that I read recently also, which makes the same point that for Biden, there was this belief that this was an anomaly, that it just happened somehow that Trump appeared. It was really lots of luck elements, like the mistakes on Hillary's side, and actually the electoral system. As you know, Hillary won 3 million votes more than Trump, but because of the electoral system, Trump became president. So everything people believed was some kind of anomaly. But the second time cannot be an anomaly anymore. And I think that second time now leads people, and it's too early to speak now, but I think to a really reassessment of the entire period of neoliberal globalization in the United States, even from the side of non-Trumpists. Like, what did go wrong? And why do we have actually 77 million people who are voted for Trump?
And do you think that in Europe we have, let's say, a chance for a more stable political system because we have more instruments to kind of also, you know, safeguard that inequality doesn't get out of control?
Oh, for Europe, definitely, Europe has more instruments for the control of inequality. And to give you an example, for example, I use that in my class very often. I like to compare, for example, Germany and the U.S. You know, they are big countries and so on. But when you compare, when you look at what economists call market income, which means before government intervention, that is really what the market generates, wages, essentially wages and capital incomes and so on. You have inequality, which is the same. But the role of government redistribution and to lesser extent direct taxes is such that, of course, inequality in Germany is, in terms of Gini points, like 34, and inequality in the U.S. is 41. So in other words, it is the government, and that's typical for Europe, which is stronger because of a stronger welfare state. Now, what would be interesting, or would be really particularly concerning now with Trump, is that the objective is to reduce the role of state in the U.S. further. So the gap between Europe and the U.S., I think, actually would increase under the current situation, because Trump is now going for the lower taxation on the rich and actually very regressive tax system. So it is really going to be much greater inequality and much more of neoliberalism domestically, but neo-mercantilism externally.
Branko, thank you so much for this wonderful discussion. I encourage everybody to pick up your latest book. It's available in German and, of course, in English as well, right?
Yes.
What's the English title?
The English title is Visions of Inequality. Yeah. And I just wanted to mention also that in English, there is just published in the UK now, the compendium, well, sort of selection of my short essays. It's called The World Under Capitalism.
And the German title of it is Visionen der Ungleichheit. So basically the same just translated into German. Just wanted to mention that. And my last question is, what book would you recommend?
The book that actually influenced me quite a lot that I read only recently is a French economic historian. Last name is Aurin. The book is called Le Capitalisme de la Finitude. And basically, the argument there, it looks at 200 years of capitalist development and looks at the periods of neo-mercantilism, like what we expect to be the next period, and how frequent they were and why they were essentially driven by political forces. And then, on the other hand, the periods of laissez-faire and periods of free trade. But I think it's actually a very rich book because it really situates the current moment in historical duration. So it is something that we have seen before.
Branko, thanks a lot for coming to our studio.
Thank you very much.
Mit dieser Buchempfehlung von unserem heutigen Gast Branko Milanovic schließen wir die Folge.
Den Link zu seinem Buchtipp finden Sie in den Shownotes, sowie auch alle Informationen zur Sommerausgabe der European Voices unter europeanvoices.eu.
Das war das zweite Kapitel unserer East Side Stories. Jeden letzten Donnerstag im Monat erscheint eine neue Podcast-Folge.
Danke, dass Sie dabei waren. Hören Sie uns wieder.
Servus.
Dos Fushanya.